Georgia's primary elections take place tomorrow, delayed due to the coronavirus pandemic. More than 1 million people have voted already, thanks to a record surge of voting by mail. Chris Acuff is a professor in political science on our campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
Chris, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we have the Georgia primary a little later than originally scheduled for obvious reasons.
Yeah, the COVID pandemic sort of thrown everybody through a loop, including election administrators. So, yeah, it got postponed, I believe, twice, actually, from the original dates. So last time we talked was leading up to Super Tuesday, and some of those, it seems like several months have passed, even though it hadn't been that many. But so several states are now getting back to the point where they're conducting elections. So we saw a few last week, and then we'll see some this week as well.
And then focusing on the contests, the one that comes to mind is the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate seat.
We have two Senate elections coming up this year. The first will be David Perdue's, the current incumbent seat. But Democrats, particularly John Ossoff, as well as a couple others, are vying to run against him. So whereas the Republican race is uncontested, the Democrats have several candidates. So John Ossoff, who sort of made waves several years ago by overperforming in Georgia's 6th district for a fairly strong Republican district, lost only by a couple points. And so he's been sort of an up-and-comer in Georgia politics. But also former Columbus Mayor Teresa Tomlinson, another candidate, Sarah Riggs Amico, who ran for lieutenant governor a couple of years ago. So I think John Ossoff is probably favored. He's definitely leading in terms of money raised, in terms of money spent on advertising and things like that. So I think he's probably, at least the consensus from the political classes, favorite to win the Democratic nomination. But again, with everything going on in the world and turnouts likely to be different in certain areas depending upon COVID and other things like that, we'll just have to see how it shakes out.
It's a different story for the special election for Georgia's other Senate seat in November and for the other party now holding that seat.
That'll be an open election in November, but you've already sort of seen some waves in that race. The current Senator Kelly Loeffler was appointed and sworn in back in January with Doug Collins, who originally had President Trump's sort of tacit endorsement. You saw Governor Brian Kemp point her to that seat, the former Senator Johnny Isaacson seat. The current senator is going through some tough times, at least in the press, in terms of some of her stock trades and other things like that. But with Representative Collins challenging her, obviously Donald Trump carries a lot of weight within the Republican Party in Georgia and a lot of other fairly conservative states. And so you saw him during the impeachment process before it got to the trial in the Senate, was he was very vocal in support of President Trump. Within the party in Georgia, the Republican Party in Georgia, you'll likely see a lot of people who support Donald Trump probably lend themselves more to Doug Collins versus the incumbent. And so at least early polling in that race shows that she's definitely behind, actually trailing in some cases with a 4 or 5 or 6 way head to head, a couple of the Democratic candidates in that. So what will end up happening in that race is the top two will go on regardless of party. If it's a Doug Collins and Kelly Loeffler, then those two will go on. If it's a Democrat and a Republican, those two will go on. So that will be an interesting race. And so if no one gets 50%, there will be a runoff next January. So we've still got a little while on that race, but considering the dynamics of everything going on politically across the country and here in the South, you'll likely see a lot of developments in that race.
And describe for us the presence of the two major parties in North Georgia within our listening area. For sure, we're talking about a red area.
In North Georgia, I would say there really isn't a presence very much of two parties. If you look at electoral maps and voting patterns, at least in the last few decades, as Republicans have made a lot of inroads, particularly in more rural areas, is essentially everything north of Atlanta up to the Tennessee border is a solidly red area of the country. So if you look at election returns, for instance, from the 2018 gubernatorial election, where you had Stacey Abrams versus Brian Kemp, those counties in North Georgia were voting, 80-85% Republican. Statewide, that's a contrast to areas maybe around Atlanta or some of the other larger cities, Columbus or Augusta or Athens with the University of Georgia. So geographically and demographically, it's reflected in Georgia the same as it is across the country, where people in cities and in metropolitan areas tend to lean a little bit more Democratic, or they tend to be more, purple areas, as we call them. That's a good mix of Democratic and Republican areas. But North Georgia, at least again for the last couple of decades, has been solidly Republican. So at least for the members of Congress running there, and in terms of Senate votes, in terms of the presidential vote, is I wouldn't expect too much to change in the dynamics of North Georgia.
But what might change statewide is which way Georgia falls in the presidential election this time. Is this the time where Georgia may turn blue given the demographic changes in the Atlanta area?
I'll hedge and say it could. A lot of those states, Texas being one, Arizona being one, Georgia being one, obviously are these states where the Democratic Party is looking for changes. And again, if you just look at the geography, big cities are changing that, whether it's Atlanta in Georgia and some of the other metropolitan areas, whether it's big cities in Texas or in Arizona, you see a lot of the changing patterns across the country. We tended to see historically, you know, what we called the Solid South was Democratic control of a lot of the Southeast particularly. And so again, over the last 50 or so years, we've seen a change. But again, Georgia could be one of these states that changes. I would say if I were betting, and I'm not going to, but you know, I would say maybe not yet, but it's certainly trending that way. So again, if you look at early polls, which we're still a ways out from November, but if you look at early polls between the presidential race or the Senate races, is most head-to-head Democratic versus Republican matchups are within a few points of each other. So again, depending on the impact, potential impact of COVID, economic factors of lots of things going on in the country, I mean, all those things could potentially affect turnout in November. Depending on the circumstances, we certainly could see a Georgia or other states that are sort of close in terms of the margins of error in these polls. We could see them flip for sure.
And among the events that could turn things one way or the other, the killing of George Floyd, the case in Brunswick.
With a lot of the, you know, I guess we could call it civil unrest that's happening, and particularly in a lot of cities, particularly amongst the African-American community and communities of color, amongst younger people who want to see change or who are upset at the current status quo, as we could call it, in terms of leadership or the lack thereof in maybe certain cities or states or the country. You see a lot of these movements. And so generally, I mean, obviously within parties and electorally, is these social movements can certainly have an impact. So that'll be an interesting dynamic leading up to maybe August primaries and then the November general election. But certainly those being on the forefront of a lot of people's minds, you know, considering tomorrow's election in Georgia, those things can certainly impact, one, people's sort of mindset, maybe their motivation for going to the polls, but also in terms of turnout. Traditionally, in terms of turnout, obviously young people tend to vote at lower rates compared to older people. And so, for instance, if there are a lot of young people who are fired up about making change, about making waves, making their voices heard at the ballot box, you could certainly see them disrupt the status quo in terms of leadership and maybe in terms of who we expect to turn out in these elections. Again, a lot of these tragic events, and sometimes we call them focusing events in public policy or political science, is, you know, some tragedy happens, some major milestone occurs, and then we can sort of trace back big social movements and social change and electoral outcomes to a lot of those changes. So you could certainly see the killing of George Floyd and some of these other tragic cases certainly shape the electoral landscape going forward.
And not only just one event or one type of event, but a cascade of COVID, right, economic, George Floyd, on and on and on and on and on. That's why there are so many people out there talking about parallels with 1968 or the early 1970s and other eras in our history.
Yeah, it's certainly been, at least for a few of the younger generations, the first time, right, that we've experienced all of these things aligned with each other. So again, you know, people are looking back several decades at some of the turmoil during the civil rights era and a little bit post that during Vietnam. But right, then we have this X factor of this pandemic. And so rarely in our history, and I won't be a historian, but, you know, rarely in our history have we seen, you know, a confluence of so many different sort of nationally impactful events to where all of these things could sort of converge at the same time and potentially impact people's motivation for turning out, even their ability to turn out in a lot of cases. And so, again, a lot of sort of questions going forward into how these are going to impact the election, how campaigns are going to reach out to voters. So, you know, just logistically, you can no longer probably knock on people's doors and have them want to answer. You will see a lot of candidates probably, again, reaching out to younger voters. And we've already seen that with a lot of the protest movements we've seen in cities, as we see a lot of elected officials going out and trying to speak with a lot of younger voters who maybe either haven't been old enough to vote or who have never engaged in the political process before. So again, a lot of these things can certainly make an impact going forward. And then in terms of election administration, are we going to be able to vote by mail? Some states we can. Tennessee recently ruled this past week that, so at least for the time being, is people will be allowed to request absentee ballots when they previously may not have been able to. So all of these different factors can definitely have an impact on our elections going forward. And so it'll be interesting to see how candidates and campaigns sort of respond to all these factors.
All right. We'll be watching. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me.